Well, it's great to welcome you back as we are continuing our studies of the book of Romans. We're coming this morning to one of the most important texts in all the Bible treating a particular topic, and that's the question of how Christian people are to relate to civil authority. This comes up, of course, in chapter 13 of Romans, and we've noted that it's part of a broad discussion that the Apostle Paul is carrying on with respect to these Christian people who live in Rome. And of course, they live in Rome in the first century, the time of the great Roman Empire, which had expanded its domains throughout the known world at that point, and certainly represented the greatest empire that the world had ever seen up until that date, and really has ever seen since. And it was right in the middle of this time in which the Roman world was at its greatest power, its greatest expanse, that Paul writes a letter to the Christian people in the very heart of that great empire, addressing this issue of how Christian people are to see their relationship to civil authority. Obviously, the Roman Empire was not conspicuously noted for its virtue. It hadn't quite gotten as bad yet as it eventually would. The emperors that had ruled over Rome, at least to this point, had generally been pretty good. Certainly, Julius Caesar, the guy who really established the Roman Empire, was assassinated in 44 BC, but his successor, his nephew Octavian, who eventually became Augustus Caesar, was the one who really established the great prestige that we associate with what we think of as the Roman Empire. He was succeeded by a stepson, Tiberius, not quite as talented, but certainly maintained a fairly credible expression of Roman authority. Tiberius, unfortunately, left the empire to a rather unfortunate character, Caligula, literally Little Boots. His actual name was Gaius, but he, for whatever reasons, had a complete meltdown shortly after he took the throne and was only able to rule from 37 to 41, and then he was assassinated just because he had become such a very, very impossible character and was doing all kinds of rather insane things. He was replaced by Claudius Caesar, and Claudius Caesar was, in fact, a quite competent ruler. He ruled from 44 to, I should say, from 41 until 54. He himself, unfortunately, was assassinated by his wife Agrippina, who was trying to posture her son. Her son was actually the stepson of Claudius to become the next emperor, and that stepson's name was Nero. And so on the death of Claudius, Nero, as a teenager, took the throne. That was in 54. Well, Paul is writing this letter to the Romans in 56, and it's fairly early in the reign of Nero. Nero, of course, is going to become the most notorious Roman Caesar of all time. He's the first Caesar to launch an official persecution of Christian people, but that won't take place for a few years. That's going to be really inaugurated in the year 64 as a result of the fire that burns up about a third of the city of Rome, and at least as the story goes, Nero had to blame somebody, and the most convenient scapegoat, it seemed, on the block at the time was this newly forming Christian sect there in the city of Rome. But none of that has happened yet. At this point, we're still fairly early in the reign of Nero, and at least at this point, he's under the guidance of some fairly competent individuals. Seneca, the Stoic philosopher, is one of the counselors to Nero. Another is his own mother, Agrippina. Another one is Burrus, who happened to be the head of the Praetorian Guard, and the three of them together form a kind of council, which really gives some pretty good guidance to Nero. He is going to break free from their council about the year 60, and from that point on, things go from bad to worse. So that's helpful to at least understand that Paul is writing these things against a backdrop of a Roman government, which at least at this point had not become utterly viciously hostile to all virtue and certainly not to all Christians. At the same time, having said that, I really don't think Paul would have said anything different even if things had been that ugly. Now, people differ on this, but my own view is what Paul is giving here are fundamental principles that have to do with the entire way we understand civil government. And even those occasions when we find ourselves under a civil government that may be corrupt, and by the way, most governments are corrupt, you know, even when we find ourselves under governments that may in fact be persecuting virtue and elevating vice, which does occasionally happen, even then, I think Paul would say these things because he's speaking in principle. And at least in principle, the things that he says here are true. In the context of Romans, why is he giving us this information at this time? Well, again, his purpose is to give us the practical application of the theology that he has worked out in the first 11 chapters of this great epistle. The great themes of Romans, salvation by grace, the people of God being established based on faith, a great equalizing of the human race because there is no difference. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. All can equally be justified by faith and so on. All of these great themes give rise to a practical effect, which is the point Paul is addressing now. He seems to be working out in a series of concentric circles. We've noted that before. He starts with the community of faith, the fellowship of Christian people in the church, kind of works out from there, you might say, to neighbors, people not in the church, but people with whom we may associate on a daily basis. Sometimes the relationships with those people may be hostile. It may be that because of our Christian faith and their lack of it, there may be some sparks flying, there may be some friction, there may be some persecution. Paul gives us practical counsel as to how to respond to such circumstances, that we should not be overcome by evil, but should overcome evil with good. That's his counsel and it's good advice. Now, beginning in chapter 13, he pushes out the circle even further and is going to incorporate now in his conversation this notion of the civil authority. And that's really what we want to take up. And I say it's one of the most important texts on that topic because really, in all the Bible, you don't have a more systematic treatment of this theme than what we find right here. This is by far the most famous text to address the question of how Christians are to relate to civil authority. It's not the only text, for sure. There are certainly other points that the issue is addressed. Jesus himself says, you know, render to Caesar what is Caesar and to God what is God's. I mean, we have those statements here and there, and certainly the other gospel writers will allude to this, but this is the point where we find the most clear and a delineation of the theme. So we're going to read it with some interest on that basis. We're going to start in chapter 13. At verse 1, and we'll read down to verse 7, and then we'll, as time permits, have a discussion of what's being stated here. So, Romans chapter 13, beginning at verse 1, the Word of God. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those authorities that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Do you wish to have no fear of the authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive its approval. For it is God's servant for your good. But if you do what is wrong, you should be afraid, for the authority does not bear the sword in vain. It is the servant of God to execute wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be subject not only because of wrath, but also because of conscience. For the same reason, you also pay taxes, for the authorities are God's servants, busy with this very thing. Pay to all what is due them. Taxes to whom taxes are due, revenue to whom revenue is due, respect to whom respect is due, and honor to whom honor is due. So there's the text we'll be considering. Let's just have a word of prayer and we'll get underway. Our great God, we are grateful to you again for the rich teaching of your scriptures, which are intended to guide hearts and minds to an understanding of the way in which we should live. And we pray that our reflection on this text now would be guided by your Spirit, asking this in the name of Christ. Amen. Well, we find here, of course, one of the great ideas that runs through the Scriptures that touches political theory. The Bible is not primarily a book about political theory, as you know, just as it's not a book about biology or astronomy or other such scientific enterprises. Nevertheless, the Bible edition will occasionally address these issues. And certainly here we find the Bible taking up a topic which is related to political theory in general. We don't find the Bible ever endorses a particular political strategy. We don't find it endorsing monarchy and saying that's the way people should govern themselves. Nor do we find in the Bible some great affirmation of democracy. That's the way it should be done. There's a variety of different governmental systems that are contemplated in the Bible. Indeed, even the people of Israel in the Old Testament find themselves from time to time under a variety of kinds of governmental systems. And what we find is that regardless of the governmental system, it is possible to do it in a godly fashion. The fundamental rule that is incumbent upon a government to do this in the right way is to recognize that there is a God in heaven, and that ultimately the authorities that we exercise here on earth are loaned to us by the dignity and majesty of the God who rules in heaven. Well, of course, it's a rather rare thing to find a government that actually acknowledges that in any way that actually is very satisfying. Even if a government, however, does not acknowledge it, it nevertheless remains to be, it is the case. And so the rule that governments are supposed to abide by is to ask the question, what law has God put in place and how can we implement those rules in the way that we do government? In the history of Western jurisprudence, there have been some philosophers of law who've recognized that rather distinctly. We think about the American constitutional era, and probably the most important philosopher of law at the time was an English jurist by the name of William Blackstone. William Blackstone starts off his great work, Commentaries on the Laws of England, by announcing right off the bat that there is a great law of nature. God has placed it there. He has written on the human heart and into the nature of things this law. And Blackstone affirms that if we try to pass laws as human beings that are inconsistent with those laws of nature, the laws we try to pass are no law at all. They are, if I can put it this way, illegal laws. And that was really at the core, at least, of the American constitutional theory. That has been largely abandoned, I'm sorry to tell you. In more recent years, really since the turn of the 20th century, we find that whole notion of natural law has been more or less jettisoned, and there's not much attention paid to it anymore at this point. But it does seem to be an idea found in the scriptures, and at least at times we find that great legal thinkers have adopted that rule. And so when we think of it from the governmental point of view, I think we can see at least that there should be some responsibility to try to recognize that God has written rules into the structure of things that should be respected as we attempt to pass positive law in our legislative enterprises. When we look at it from the other perspective, the point of view of somebody who is under these laws, then we need to at the same time recognize that there is a duty to see in the government that is over us the imprint, the hand, the dignity of God. Those governments may or may not be acting very well with respect to that authority that's been loaned to them by God, but that doesn't vitiate the fact that we're supposed to realize that God is somehow in this thing and to treat it accordingly, even when the government itself may be misbehaving. There are limits to this, of course. But the fundamental rule is that we recognize God's authority in the governmental system. And so Paul tells us, let every person be subject to the governing authorities. Be subject to them. Recognize that in these governing authorities there is a dignity that has been communicated to them from God Himself. Paul says, for there is no authority except from God. It's a powerful statement. It's one that would be worth a fairly extensive conversation in itself. There is no authority except from God. That is the only authority there is. The Greek word for authority is an interesting word. It's the word exousia, E-X-O-U-S-I-A. It's a combination of two words, ek, which means out of, and ousia, which means substance. And literally, authority means that which is out of substance. It carries the idea of weight, of a kind of majestic dignity, a sort of ballast. And the point Paul's driving at is that there is none of that legitimate authority, this kind of authority that derives of sheer dignity, except from God. God is the one whose holiness and majesty gives rise to the very possibility that there could be authority at all. When Jesus opened his mouth and spoke, as we find recorded in the Gospels, people would leave and sometimes say something like this: "I've never heard anyone speak like this before. The man speaks with authority." And the word he uses there is exousia. The man speaks out of weight, out of substance. Now, that's not because Jesus had some kind of official office. He wasn't the mayor of the town. He wasn't a state senator. He wasn't otherwise in a position of being the prime minister or having some kind of authority that was conferred upon him by a bureaucratic status. No, nothing of the sort. He's a guy that shows up and begins speaking, and the mere weight of his person communicates a sense of authority. And that's the authority that the Bible is speaking of, and that Paul in particular is speaking of here. The authority that is given to government, the dignity, the weight that is given, can only be because there is God. The New Testament does know another word that is sometimes translated authority, but is more the notion of power. This is the word kratos, K-R-A-T-O-S. If you know the word democracy, the demokratos part, the kratos means power. The demos means people, power of the people. But interestingly, the word kratos means power in the sense of coercive power. It's the kind of power I have over you if I come at you with a baseball bat or with a gun or some kind of implement of coercion. I may exercise some authority over you in that sense, but it's not legitimate authority necessarily. It's not the authority that necessarily reflects that which is given by God. It's not the weight and substance of ousia, but it's rather simply the ability to extort from you behavior because I have some kind of more powerful position to work from, you see. Both kinds of authorities are recognized, but what Paul means here is the only authority that really represents a kind of majestic authority, the kind of authority that speaks of weight and majesty and holiness, can only come from God. Human governments may abuse it. Human governments may, in fact, take that authority and use it in wrong ways. And we can be wise and recognize that, but it nevertheless still stands to be the case that the authority is there. It may be abused, but it's still legitimate authority from God. It's just legitimate authority being abused, you know. And Christians have to be discerning as they evaluate how that authority is being exercised. There is no authority except from God. Paul says those authorities that exist, therefore, by the nature of the case, have been instituted by God. There's no authority from God, and thus any authorities we encounter in this world ultimately owe their very existence to God. And even if those authorities are going in a bad direction, I can still recognize in the principle of the thing that that authority, though abused, is still from God, and that authority, when not abused, can be at the same time exercising its role as an authority because of God's appointment of it in that status. Therefore, Paul continues by necessary logic, whoever resists an authority, meaning a civil authority, a human authority, is resisting what God has appointed, and by the nature of the case, therefore resisting God himself. When I encounter the policeman who is carrying legitimate authority from government, which got its authority from God, if I resist that policeman, I am resisting God. That's Paul's point. It doesn't mean everything the policeman does is right. You see, this is where there's a certain amount of discernment, but it means that my responsibility toward that officer, even when the officer is misguided, is to be one of respecting the authority that that person carries in his office. Rulers, Paul continues, are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Now, this is one of those truisms that is usually to be relied upon, but not always. I would say in the vast majority of cases, even under governments that are bad governments, if you do the right thing, you are going to largely be unmolested by that government. We certainly know that there have been governments in history that have persecuted virtue. It's not uncommon. It's happening right now in the present world. You know, we know that that takes place, but it does represent a bit of an exception. For the most part, what Paul is saying here, and that's the way he intends for us to take this, for the most part, we can rest on the proposition that rulers generally don't terrorize good conduct. They are after evil conduct. So Paul says, as a matter of practical insight, if you wish to have no fear of the authority, then just do what is good. Even if the government is bad, nevertheless, if you, in the ordinary course of events, do what is good, you're not going to run into difficulties with that government. And for the most part, governments, though they may be bad, are still concerned about maintaining civil order, maintaining a certain degree of stability with respect to the economic system, and so on. These are concerns the government will ordinarily have because that makes life for the government a little bit easier, you know. There's a kind of self-interest that's involved in a government maintaining an orderly kind of way of life for us, even if the government itself may be motivated by less than virtuous concerns. Do what is good, Paul says, you'll receive its approval. For it is God's servant for your good. Interesting word Paul uses here. It's God's diakonos. It's the word from which we get the English word deacon. It's a word that's sometimes applied to an office in the church, somebody who has a kind of practical responsibility for practical service in the church. I think you know that word. But it also stands generally for just being a practical servant, a deacon, a diakonos. And that's exactly what Paul is saying. The civil government is acting as his deacon. When you look at a policeman, that's God's deacon, you see. That's God's servant, acting with God's authority to do things which in the ordinary course of events are going to be good. And so we should treat it that way and see in some sense or other the very dignity of God in this human office, this human institution that we may be reckoning with. He says, if you do what is wrong, you should be afraid, for the authority does not bear the sword in vain. Here we have an allusion to the other kind of authority. You see, there's two kinds of authority, aren't there? There is the authority of intrinsic dignity, and there is also the authority of the sword. Now, God has invested and intended that the authority have both kinds. And of course, it's right that it should. Policemen usually carry weapons. And the reason they do is because some people don't respect the authority that's given to them by God, and the policeman needs to have the implements of more coercive kinds of means in order to get a certain degree of conformity to the required behavior. We Christians, of course, are called to obey the authority not because it's bearing the sword, but because of conscience. We are called to obey the authority precisely because God is in it. And that should be sufficient reason. But, Paul says, if we're going to disregard the authority, then that other power, that sword power, may come after us at the same time. So we find a dual track analysis on Paul's part of how the authority should operate. He says it's the servant of God to execute wrath on the wrongdoer. I don't want to spend too much time on this. I'll just make the point in passing that this discussion Paul is raising here of the use of the sword has been used many times in the history of the church to be a kind of a New Testament justification for the use of capital punishment. I want to tread cautiously here, but at the same time, I think at least it needs to be noted that this particular text has been one of the more important on that subject. Certainly, we find in the Old Testament a very free and widely applied use of capital punishment. I think you know that. In the Old Testament, there's something like 32 separate crimes, any one of which would be a capital offense. There's always been a question whether in the New Testament we find an adjustment. Do we find that capital punishment is either abrogated or greatly restricted? I think that's probably a conversation for another day, and I'd really like to have that conversation on another day, but we're going to leave it for the time being at this, that at least this text does seem to suggest there is some legitimate place for the use of capital punishment. Obviously, it can be greatly abused and has been in many cases, and I think Christians who are thoughtful on the subject want to be rather cautious as they think about how capital punishment might be implemented in a given society, and some would prefer to just play it safe, you know, and not use that particular device at all. But like I say, I'm going to leave that alone. But at least this reference to the sword has been virtually always recognized to be some kind of authorization of and confirmation of the right of a civil authority to exercise that kind of punitive response to crime. So, Paul continues, therefore one must be subject not only because of wrath, the sword, but also because of conscience. You see, we have two reasons to be subject. One better, one worse. The better reason to be subject, frankly, is because of conscience. We should be subject to the authority because we see God's dignity in it. That's the best reason. That's the proper reason. But there's also a supplementary reason that should be there as well, namely, that this authority that God has ordained, He has not left without the devices of coercion. And so if conscience doesn't reach you, then maybe simple fear and enlightened self-interest will. One way or another, however, Paul, of course, wants us to understand that our responsibility is one of being subject to the authority, and that that becomes honoring to God, and certainly more honoring to God if we do it out of a proper conscientious recognition of the fact that God is in it. For the same reason, Paul says, you should pay taxes. Taxes can be highly controversial. And sometimes people feel that taxes are illegal, unjust. They're being imposed in ways that are not proper at all. And I'm sure that that's the case. And at this point, Paul is simply affirming, however, that the very fact that there is government, the very fact that the government has been ordained by God, also gives rise to the practical necessity that that government be sustained. In the ordinary course of events, governments don't produce anything. They don't sell any products. They don't have any basis for revenue except tax. And God seems to have ordained that we should pay a certain amount in order to sustain government. I fully agree with you, probably, that sometimes taxes can be way too high and that government can waste an awful lot of its revenue. And so at this point, I don't think we need to understand Paul as somehow endorsing everything the government may do with its tax revenue, but that there should be a tax system that is proper and just and that it should be used to sustain government seems to be pretty clear from the text. So you pay your taxes, for the authorities are God's servants, busy with this very thing. Pay to all what is due them, taxes to whom taxes are due, revenue to whom revenue is due, respect to whom respect is due, honor to whom honor is due. There is a responsibility that Christian people have to recognize that God has put these authorities in place and to give them their due. If you live in a situation, in a country, where you have the opportunity to try to influence government for the better, it seems to me that the Bible certainly gives you ample reason to see that as a legitimate thing to be about. Some people believe they should be utterly insulated and isolated from any sort of political activity whatsoever. Others would almost marry political activity with their religion. Somewhere out there in the middle is probably the proper balance, where responsible citizens in a given society should very much be concerned about the propriety of the governmental processes that are involved, and yet at the same time be cautious not to confuse them so that somehow our politics becomes indistinguishable from our religious convictions. They are certainly related. They are not the same thing. And certainly it seems that from Paul's point of view, we need to have a kind of proper and responsible appraisal of that. Well, that brings us now to the last half of chapter 12, where Paul is going to reach probably the fundamental theme that he wants to deal with here, which is the fact that as we are engaged in a life of obedience, that there is a root virtue that really justifies everything that we do, and that root is love. And so the last half of chapter 13 is going to be Paul shifting his focus now to this question of love and loving one another. And that really is going to be the preparation for the discussion that we'll have in chapter 14, which has to do with dealing with differences among Christians where there may be a legitimate difference of opinion on various practices that are somewhat secondary in their character. So we're going to be working toward that discussion in chapter 14 next time. And until then, may God richly bless you.